I'm Tommy McNeil. Midway through the fiscal year, the United States is on track to resettle one of the lowest numbers of refugees in the resettlement history. From October 1st, 2018 through March 31st, 12,151 refugees came to the U.S., primarily from three countries: the Democratic Republic of Congo, 40%, Burma, 17%, and Ukraine. That's according to the U.S. State Department statistics. The Trump administration may, meanwhile, reassign port inspectors at the southern border to help deal with the surge of migrants there. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
As many as 2,000 inspectors who screen cargo and vehicles could be temporarily reassigned to instead process migrants. That's up from the current 750 inspectors who've been shifted. The effects are being seen in El Paso, where thousands of would-be border crossers were waiting about an hour to come into the U.S. Separately, President Trump's being warned of the economic consequences if he follows through on a threat to shut down the entire Mexican border. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce says the U.S. and Mexico trade about $1.7 billion in goods daily. Closing the border would be a debacle and threaten 5 million American jobs. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Algerian president's office has longtime leader Abdelaziz Bouteflika will step down by April 28th. When his term is due to end. The statement was carried by the state APS news agency Monday. It said that Bouteflika will ensure the continuity of the state's institutions before stepping down. That announcement comes after weeks of mass protest against the president and his government. Last week, Algeria's powerful army chief shocked the nation by calling for Bouteflika to be declared unfit and removed from office. This is VOA News. Firefighters are struggling now to douse a forest fire that broke out in the mountains of southwestern China over the weekend, killing at least 26 firefighters, with four missing, according to state media. The fire broke out Saturday in the Muli County and perched at an altitude of more than 4,000 meters with poor transport and communication links. Sunday afternoon, authorities have sent nearly 700 firefighters to put out the blaze, but 300 disappeared after a surge of flames fed by a sudden shift in the wind. China now says that it will start regulating fentanyl-related drugs as a class of controlled substances. AP correspondent Matt Small reports.
U.S. officials have pointed to China as the main source of synthetic opioids shipped into the country directly by mail or transported via Mexico, a claim China denies. Now in a sweeping policy shift U.S. officials have long pushed for and due to take effect May 1st, China will begin regulating all fentanyl-related drugs as a class of controlled substances. A Chinese official says the move should block the loopholes by which drug makers created new variants of opioids faster than they could be banned. Matt Small, Washington.
A Vietnamese woman is now the only suspect remaining in detention in Malaysia for the killing of the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. A lawyer for Don Taiwong said that his client has instead pleaded guilty to a lesser charge of causing hurt by dangerous weapons or means. An Israeli watchdog says that it has found fake social media accounts promoting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the lead up to national elections. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma.
Researchers at the Big Bots Project say they've identified a network of social media bots where fake accounts have spread messages in support of Netanyahu's Likud party and smearing his opponents. The researchers, though, haven't found a direct link between the network and Netanyahu or Likud, though Netanyahu's son has frequently liked posts by the network's accounts. The Likud party denies any connection to the network. Israelis head to the polls in 8 days in a close race between Netanyahu and his main rival, former Army Chief of Staff Benny Gantz. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The Algerian president's office again saying that the longtime leader, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, stepping down by April 28th. Margaret Bashir at the United Nations has contributing to a report that Venezuela's Chief Justice is asking lawmakers to strip opposition leader Juan Guaido of his parliamentary immunity, a move that could pave the way for him to be jailed. The justice on Monday said that Guaido should be jailed for violating a Supreme Court-imposed ban on leaving the country. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudanese are gearing up for a multi-continental million-person march this Saturday.
We don't want to have any bloodshed in Sudan. We want and we will continue in a very civil and very peaceful way.
Elamin Shingraya is a member of the Political Bureau of the 27 November Movement. Meanwhile, a Sudanese graffiti artist honors anti-government protest victims. A recent study looks at the impact of the notorious per diem payments on Guinea-Bissau journalists. And a look at 25 years after the genocide in Rwanda.
Because of female legislators' leadership on this issue, Rwanda became one of the countries in the world that really put forth progressive and innovative laws and also institutions related to countering and preventing gender-based violence.
And that's Maureen Berry of the University of Denver. Muslim brotherhoods play key roles in the daily lives of Senegalese, and an NGO struggles to protect Cameroon's waters from invasive plants. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Preparations are being finalized for Saturday's million-person protest to demand the ouster of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. The protest will take place simultaneously in Khartoum and New York City. It coincides with the 34th anniversary of the April 6, 1985 ouster of then-leader Ghalfa el-Nimeiri. Demonstrations against current President Bashir's government first began over fuel shortages and a hike in food prices. But now the protesters want Mr. Bashir to step down. On Monday, Mr. Bashir said the protesters' demand were legitimate and promised to achieve peace through dialogue. Elamin Shingraya is a member of the Political Bureau of the 27 November Movement. He says the unified message of Saturday's million-person protest is that President Bashir must step down.
We plan this Saturday, 6th of April, for a big march here in New York City, starting from the famous square there in New York. And also, we have the biggest march planned to be in the capital of Sudan, Khartoum. That is on the same day of the uprising of April 6, 1985, which was against President Dictator Jafar Nimeiri, maybe 35 years ago. And now we are planning to do the same march again against military dictatorship.
What is the significance of this April 6th to the other protests that have been going on?
The other protests, in some extent, was in local areas. There wasn't a big one for all the people in the capital in Khartoum. But this one is open for all Sudanese. The other significant also, we are pushing to have the million person walk out. That will be the biggest one of all.
As you know, the protest began over fuel shortages and the hiking food prices. President Bashir was speaking Monday, and he said that the demands that the protesters have been making are legitimate. In fact, he's calling on the opposition to join the national dialogue.
This is one of the tactics of this military dictator. Sometimes he changed the rhetoric, changed the way he talks to the people, and sometimes he starts to, as if he is accepting what the people demand from him. But actually, after 30 years and three decades, we come to understand the way he talk and the way he built his policies and how he delivered the policies. So there is not any kind of trust from us on his government or anyone who can represent him. We feel that the damage which had been happening in Sudan during all these 30 years is so big and so huge to the extent that we don't feel any partial change in the government will make a good result of it. We think that the whole system should be restructured and change should be taken from its roots to build a new system. If 30 years is not enough for you to make the good change, or at least to maintain what was there, then why we should give you another 30 years or another 10 years to play?
As you know, the Sudanese security forces have clamped down heavily on the protesters in Khartoum. Are you not concerned that this Saturday's march will be met by violence?
We know that this is their strategy to push us, all the demonstrators and all the people of Sudan. They want to push us to the other side, not the peaceful way. We keep telling the people, never think about any violent way against the government. Do not give them the tool and the reason to use the arms against us. And we don't want to have any bloodshed in Sudan. We want and we will continue in a very civil and very peaceful way.
Thank you very much again, sir. We are so happy to speak with you.
Thank you. You're most welcome.
Elamin Shingraya is a member of the Political Bureau of the 27 November Movement. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. As Sudan's government seeks to quell months of anti-government protests that have left more than 50 people dead, a Sudanese graffiti artist is painting portraits of deceased demonstrators. Naba Muhideen reports from Khartoum.
Sudanese graffiti artist Asil Diab lives in Qatar, but earlier this year returned to the country of her birth. Diab came to honor protesters who were killed in Sudan's months-long anti-government demonstrations.
Initially, I wanted to participate in the protests in Sudan. It took a long time for me to convince my parents to come to Sudan and participate in the revolution. And once I got here, I heard a lot of stories about the martyrs, and it was very emotional, and I just had to do something about that.
Diab began visiting families of protesters who were killed and painting their portraits as a memorial on the walls of the buildings where they once lived. Relatives warmly welcomed Diab into their homes. Abu Bakr Umar's 24-year-old son, Abdul Azim, was killed in January, allegedly shot by police during a protest. He says Diab's painting has renewed the memory of Abdul Azim's becoming a martyr. Whenever he sees the painting, adds Umar, he feels like Abdul Azim is still here with them. Diab also paints those killed in earlier protest clashes, such as Adila Mustafa's son, Musab, who was shot at 826 during 2013 protests. She says that when the painting was made, she wasn't there. When she saw it for the first time, she was surprised. It's a painful memory for her, says Mustafa. At least 50 people have been killed in Sudan since protests broke out in late December over price hikes and fuel shortage. The demonstrations quickly morphed into calls for President Omar al-Bashir to leave power. A pioneer of Sudan's modern art, Rashid Diab, no relation, says Asil Diab's work is empowering the protest movement. He says that freedom of expression in painting is very important. It gives the actual value to the Revolutionary Act. It fuels the Revolutionary Act, increases its power, flame, and importance, he says. It creates the pillars of a future civilized presence. Diab's portraits of protest victims can be found in Khartoum and in Omdurman and Bahri, Sudan's other major cities. At the street level, Diab says her graffiti portraits spark discussions about how unarmed protesters became casualties.
And once I start painting in the streets, people as well, the audience, they stop and ask. It connects me with the families and the families with the public, and there's an immediate connection between everyone that walks by the artwork.
As Diab prepared to leave Sudan this month, she visited the families of the victims and gave some of the portraits a touch-up. Diab says she hopes that on her next visit to Sudan, there will be fewer portraits for her to paint. Naba Muhideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The genocide in Rwanda 25 years ago left an estimated 800,000 people, mostly Tutsis, dead. Since then, Rwanda has made progress in recovering from the devastation, growing its economy with GDP growth of 6 to 8% a year since 2003, according to the World Bank. Also, Rwanda now has the highest percentage of female parliamentarians in the world, more than 60%. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has more.
It started on April 6, 1994, when a plane carrying Rwanda's Hutu president Juvenal Habyarimana and his Burundian counterpart was shut down. Mary Berry is an international studies professor at the University of Denver in Colorado.
There was a lot of confusion and, of course, a scramble for power within his administration. And over the next several months, the targets expanded and Tutsi civilians in Rwanda became seen as the enemy. And the level of brutality, of course, was tremendous. Just over 3 months, perhaps 800,000 Rwandans were killed, and the vast majority of those killed were Tutsi.
Following the genocide, the Rwandan Patriotic Front's Paul Kagame became the nation's de facto leader, first as vice president to Pasteur Bizimungu and later president of the country. Fast forward 25 years later, people are still grappling with what happened. Nadine Yitegeka was only 3 when the genocide unfolded. She's a recent graduate from Rwanda's Akilah Institute for Women.
We have a generation now of people whose parents are in prison, a generation that is not like me. They don't even have any parents left. So trauma and healing, it's a process. We are at a good stage now.
One sign of that, the large number of women who became members of parliament.
We used to be a very patriarchal society, and seeing these women break these rules is inspiring. As a young woman, it's possible to do even beyond what they've done. Because for me, there are challenges they faced that I won't have to.
Ironically, Rwanda's genocide opened the doors for women because most of the casualties were men. With a survival rate of 70%, women entered fields once closed to them. Women lawmakers, who make up more than 60% of the seats, have made a difference in crafting policy, according to Berry.
Perhaps the most notable one was a bill related to gender-based violence. And Rwanda's, because of female legislators' leadership on this issue, Rwanda became one of the countries in the world that really put forth progressive and innovative laws and also institutions related to countering and preventing gender-based violence.
But Berry, who wrote a book about women and violence in Rwanda and Bosnia-Herzegovina, says Rwandan women still have a long way to go.
There hasn't been a transformation of patriarchal power relations within the home or within marriage, and there has not been a fundamental, real transformation of how political power is wielded, because the political power in Rwanda is directly rooted and kind of held by the executive.
Berry says while the Rwandan government has benefited globally from its empowerment of women in parliament, she worries about the crackdown on political dissent with the recent jailing of female opposition leaders Victoire Ingabire and Diane Ruigara. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
A recent study shows the impact of the notorious per diem payments by politicians to journalists in Guinea-Bissau have on democracy and the quality of journalism. The payments are in exchange for coverage, says Susana Sampaio Diaz, the author of the study. She spoke to Ricky Stryak about her findings and about how journalists' low salaries are one reason behind the payments.
So because the salaries in Guinea-Bissau for journalists, the base salary is so low, it makes journalists kind of like propelled to accept the situation of accepting per diem payments. They see it as like an intrinsic to the profession anyway. That's the ultimate problem. So because the sector is so poorly financed, or they have reduced financial resources, And journalists are so poorly paid, that's ultimately the connection. So to have an idea, the base salary for a journalist in Guinea-Bissau is around like 15,000 or 35,000 francs. So it's around, like, let's say in dollars, 26 to 62.
Monthly or weekly?
Monthly. And each time they go out to cover some event or to cover some story or a press conference, they are paid the per diem fee that is a fixed rate of 25,000, which is the equivalent to $44.
So in a day, well, the per diem can equal as much as they might make in a month.
Yeah, it could be higher or it could be like slightly lower, but it is what it is. So it's only possible to survive, to live as a journalist, to work as a journalist, by expecting and counting on this surplus. The thing is a little bit like working for commission, right? As a salesperson. The thing is that the per diem has this as an issue that you are not expected to be beneficial in your coverage. But if the coverage is not beneficial, you might not be called again to cover certain events.
You touch on it a bit too, even if the coverage can be quote unquote unbiased, it provides little opportunity for investigative journalism in the country, for really in-depth journalism.
Exactly. So the attractiveness of an event that it's paid for, it's much higher than something that, you know, that it goes on their own initiative. And as I've been explained, these payments come mainly from politicians, governments as well, and international organizations. But mostly, like, the highlight was about politicians and the opposition parties.
That was Susana Sampaio-Diaz, professor of journalism at the University of Portsmouth. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar, Senegal. Muslim Brotherhoods play an important role in the everyday life of Senegalese, from politics and agriculture to transportation and music. VOA's Salwa Jafari reports from the center of one of Senegal's largest brotherhoods.
With its narrow streets and sandy alleyways, Touba may not look like much, but its influence in Senegalese life is undeniable. At the end of this road, the Great Mosque, where each November, millions of pilgrims come to the tomb of Sheikh Amadou Bamba. Followers believe the Mouride Brotherhood he established is central to Islam.
The Mouride way, for us, for me personally, is everything. Because Islam equals Mouridism. And Mouridism is the path that leads us to the Islam.
Work and discipline are central to Mouride teachings. So the Brotherhood has considerable commercial interests, marked consistently by the only known image of Sheikh Bamba, who twice overcame exile by French colonists to help establish Brotherhood support for secularism and nonviolence, alongside the country's Christian first president, Léopold Sédar Senghor. Abdoulaye Wade used the Mouride network to help organize his election as president in 2000. Capitalizing on the Brotherhood's influence, like other Senegalese politicians, backed by other Brotherhoods such as the Tidjane and Layene. Historian Sheikh Gay says the Brotherhood's endorsement is critical for any Senegalese politician.
The spiritual leader is more respected by the citizen. Citizens recognize in a marabout their role model and their spiritual leader. Thus, the citizen is a disciple and the political figures are also disciples.
Touba Mosque head librarian Mustafa Diattara says Brotherhood Khalifs mediate political differences in Senegal by maintaining peace through compromise.
In the current context, as is recommended by Mouridism, the caliph has always called for calm to avoid any violence.
Unlike civilians threatened by Islamic extremists across the Sahel, Senegalese take pride in the modernizing influence of their Muslim brotherhoods, who have not pressed for Sharia law and are widely seen as helping to safeguard the country's secular democratic rule. Salwa Jafari, VOA News, Touba, Senegal.
The spread of invasive water hyacinths in and around Cameroon's port city of Douala is causing problems for residents. The hyacinth's stubborn growth hampers shipping, reduces fish catches, blocks streams, and invades houses. But local NGOs are working to clean them up, and artists are finding new uses for the hyacinths. Moki Edwin Kinzeka narrates this report by Anne Mireille Unzwanku from Cameroon's port city of Douala.
A group of artisans from the Samuel Dipoko Gallery in Douala, led by Henri Alain Samba, are using recycled water hyacinths to create artworks and display them at an exhibition. They are also teaching this kind of art to teenagers.
We want to initiate people at young ages to know water hyacinths art.
They work in collaboration with NGOs involved with the sustainable management of wetland resources, who collect the plants from the water, then dry and deliver them to the artists.
Every day we collect 2,000 to 2,500 cubic meters of free-floating perennial aquatic plants from around this area alone.
The livelihoods of thousands of residents depend on fishing, which has been hampered by the invasive plants. It grows quickly and forms large mats on the water's surface, blocking sunlight from aquatic plants and killing pond animals by using up oxygen. The overabundance of water hyacinths has led to recurrent floods and outbreaks of malaria. The high standing water is causing multiple problems.
Mosquitoes have invaded our neighborhoods and big black snakes enter our houses and attack our children. We spend a lot to buy insecticides to kill the snakes, mosquitoes, and insects, but the invasive plants remain. At first, we had clean water here, but today lack water to drink.
Locals in Douala are lauding efforts to collect water hyacinths.
The initiative.
Collecting water hyacinths and invasive plants and turning them into something of value has helped the people of Douala. In some cases, half or more of the plants were invasive. These artisans have taught us that a nuisance to health can be turned into a profitable activity.
The objects we recover can be transformed to beautiful works of art, and we are ready to assist anyone who wants to have the knowledge.
But a lot of work still lies ahead to control the water hyacinth, a plant officials say is among the world's top 100 most invasive species. For Anne-Mireille Zwanke in Douala, Cameroon, Moki, Edwin Kinzika, for VOA News.
Briefly before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Preparations are being finalized for this Saturday's million-person protest to demand the ouster of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. The protest will take place simultaneously in Khartoum and New York City. It will coincide with the 34th anniversary of the April 6, 1985 ouster of then-leader Ghalfa el-Nimeiri. Demonstrations against current President Bashir's government first began over fuel shortages and a hike in food prices. But now the protesters want Mr. Bashir to step down. On Monday, Mr. Bashir said the protesters' demand were legitimate and he promised to achieve peace through dialogue. El-Lami Shingari, a member of the political bureau of the 27th November movement, said the unified message of the Saturday's million-person protest is that the president must step down. The genocide in Rwanda 25 years ago left an estimated 800,000 people, mostly Tutsis, dead. Since then, Rwanda has made progress in recovering from the devastation, growing its economy with a GDP growth of 6 to 8% a year since 2003, according to the World Bank. And that is it for this Tuesday, April 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
VOA welcomes Sun FM in Zambia as its newest partner. VOA's popular programs, including Daybreak Africa, Africa News Tonight, the 5-Minute Newscast on the top of the hour, and of course, VOA Music Mix, can all be heard now on Sun FM, 88.5 on the Copper Belt, 95.1 and 95.5 FM in Central Province, 95.3 in Lusaka Province, and 91.7 FM in Livingston. Welcome to the VOA Radio affiliate family.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On April 7th, the United Nations marks the 25th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. More than 800,000 people, mostly Tutsi, were killed. An in-depth discussion of what Rwanda and the world has learned from this tragedy on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.